Good morning, everyone. I'm Ted Pacon. I'm a senior fellow with the Latin America Initiative here at the Brookings Institution. Welcome to what I expect will be a very interesting day of conversations, information, analysis, debate about Cuba. Today, our topic is called Rethinking Cuba, New Opportunities for Development. And I wonder if I should end that with an exclamation point or a question mark. I think we should know better by the end of the day. There's certainly a lot of enthusiasm about the topic and also a lot of questions about the future. We have a stellar roster of experts to cover the range of issues raised by the historic announcement on December 17th by Presidents Obama and Raul Castro. In just 5 months since December 17th, we've seen unprecedented progress toward reestablishing relations with Cuba and ending Cold War hostilities in favor of direct engagement, dialogue, and confidence building. We've seen new regulations in just 1 month in January and some since then to promote greater travel, trade, remittances, and direct communications. We've seen several rounds of direct talks to restore full diplomatic relations, the removal of Cuba from the list of state sponsors of terrorism, which has helped the Cuban interest section here in Washington find a bank, among other things, and has moved the ball forward toward reestablishing diplomatic relations. We've also seen a historic meeting between Raul Castro and Barack Obama in Panama at the Summit of the Americas and Cuba's first ever participation in the summit. Just last in April. We've also seen some reactions in Congress, a flurry of legislation introduced in Congress that would, on the one hand, lift the travel ban, ease trade restrictions, and end the embargo, and on the other hand, legislation to reverse liberalization, to demand action plans on property claim settlement, and restrict spending on a new embassy. In Havana, I would say the pace of change is slower, but over the last several years, we've seen a number of important changes toward gradually opening the economy, allowing Cubans to open small businesses and buy and sell property, travel more easily off the island, and very happy that all of our Cuban experts have made it from Cuba to Washington this time without any problems. That's a major achievement. A year ago, I don't think I could say that. So that's one sign of the ability to have more direct exchange and contact with folks on the island. Of course, there are big challenges up ahead. Labor market reform, currency unification, electoral law reform, and you'll hear of many more in the course of the day. So our purpose today is to take stock of these changes, examine trends in the Cuban economy in the new context of U.S.-Cuba rapprochement, evaluate the challenges and the opportunities for Cuba's economy. I want to thank the Christopher Reynolds Foundation and Atlantic Philanthropies for their support for organizing this conference. We will be tweeting today at the handle of Cuba Growth, so please check that and add your own comments in that space. As you see, we're in a full crowd today. We do have an overflow room across the hallway. So if you find yourself leaving and then coming back and you can't find a seat here, please walk just across the hallway and there will be a screen and a translation available there. We will have a quick coffee break after the second panel around 11 o'clock. And then a lunch break out of these doors on the side here. There'll be sandwiches and snacks for just half an hour from 12:30 to 1, and then we'll continue the program at 1 o'clock. There will be some PowerPoints in the course of the day. Finally, you should know that for translation, Station 2 is for English and Station 10 is for Spanish. So help yourself to that. And what we're going to start with is a discussion on current macro trends in Cuba. And we're going to first hear from Stefan Selig, who is the Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade at the Department of Commerce here in Washington. He was confirmed to his position just about 1 year ago by the U.S. Senate, and he leads, among other things, the International Trade Administration, which helps in the development of U.S. trade policy in the global economy, which is an extremely busy portfolio these days, so we're very happy to have him here. Previously, Stefan Selig served as Executive Vice Chairman of Global Corporate and Investment Banking at Bank of America Merrill Lynch, has a long experience in New York and Wall Street on mergers and acquisitions and global investment, including at Bank of America Securities, and so well known and well understands the dynamics of the global economy and the role of U.S. businesses in supporting that dynamic economy. We're very happy to have him. He's going to come speak and make some initial remarks, and then we're going to have a period of time to hear from two of our commentaries. One will be Juan Triana Cordovi. Juan is a graduate professor at the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy at the University of Havana. You have all their bios, so I'm not going to go into great detail, but we've gotten to know Juan through a series of meetings and expert workshops we've done with the University of Havana. He teaches Cuban economy and universal economic thought at the economics department at the university and travels widely around the region and the world, giving talks on the state of the Cuban economy, and has a doctorate of economics from the University of Havana. We'll then hear from Archibald Ritter. Arch is a distinguished research professor in the Department of Economics and the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University in Ottawa. We're very happy to have him here. Arch has been studying and examining Cuba for many, many years, as well as economies in Africa, and comes to us with great experience both in academia and in government at the UN. And we'll be hearing from both of them about the macro trends happening in Cuba. And then we'll take some time to for a Q&A with you all. And so let me get moving, and we'll get the program started and ask Stefan to join at the panel. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to first start off by thanking Ted and Brookings for the invitation and the opportunity to speak with all of you today. This organization, which Ted tells me is next year, will be celebrating its centennial anniversary, plays an essential role in forwarding sound public policy, and that obviously includes all the work that Ted and his team in the Latin American Initiative do. In providing understanding and guidance in the U.S.-Cuba relations. So as head of the ITA, as Ted has said, I am charged with advancing the trade and investment agenda of the country, and I thank you for everything that you have done, will do, and for your partnership. This is actually, I see some familiar faces, the second set of remarks I have delivered in the past 2 months on Cuba. The first set were in New York, back in April at the Cuba Opportunity Summit, which was sponsored by the Wharton School. During that address, I made the point that an essential way to understanding the process of normalizing relations is to see it as a journey. And as with any journey, that means there is a path and, in fact, a destination. I stated that this path means that we are embracing the policies of free enterprise and individual empowerment, and embracing the policies that yield the highest returns on the qualified, educated, and talented human capital that Cuba possesses. As for the endpoint, the destination, that would be a democratic, stable, and prosperous Cuba. Since I delivered these remarks, it has occurred to me that there is another way to understand this very process, and that is by seeing it within the context of time. And in fact, when you examine the process of normalizing bilateral relations in this context, I think three separate narratives emerge. The first narrative I would like to talk about is perhaps the simplest one, and that is separating the policy measures that have been implemented in the recent past from the ones that have not yet been implemented but may be implemented in the future. I think this is critically important given the amended regulations that have been published by the Treasury and Commerce Departments since the President's announcement this past December. And as I noted in New York, the regulations implemented by Commerce and Treasury have already facilitated travel to Cuba for authorized purposes, raised the limits on certain remittances and generally authorized certain categories of unlimited remittances to Cuba, authorized U.S. financial institutions to open correspondent accounts at Cuba financial institutions to facilitate the processing of authorized transactions, authorized certain transactions with Cuban nationals located outside of Cuba, and authorized certain other activities related to, among other areas, telecommunications, financial services, trade in certain goods and services with Cuba's private sector, and shipping. And following the completion of the 45-day congressional notification period, the Secretary of State made the final decision completing the rescission of Cuba's designation of a state sponsor of terrorism. And as we all know, that became effective last Friday, May 29th. But it is also critically important to understand what has not yet transpired. None of these measures represent a lifting of the Cuba embargo, which remains in force and codified by existing U.S. law. And none of these measures represent an endorsement of the status quo when it comes to the state of human rights in Cuba. The second narrative is separating the recent period of time focused on the reestablishment of diplomatic relations and the initial steps towards normalization from the much longer time needed for full normalization to unfold. I think, as everyone here knows, we have seen a number of events emerge in relatively short order. In fact, on the day I delivered my remarks in New York, Airbnb announced that 2,000 Cuban homes would be added to their listings. And in just the last 2 months, we have seen JetBlue announce that they would conduct a weekly flight between New York and Cuba. The issuance of specific licenses authorizing the transportation of authorized travelers by vessel. A delegation led by my governor, Governor Cuomo, the first governor-led trade mission since the December announcement. Cuba's participation in the Summit of the Americas, as well as the meetings between Presidents Obama and Castro. The removal of Cuba's designation as a state sponsor of terrorism, which I just mentioned, and the current focus on reestablishing diplomatic relations and the reopening of embassies. So there is no denying the speed of these developments. And there is also no denying the excitement from the various communities and stakeholders that these developments reflect. But let us be clear. The small amount of time during which these events emerge should not be confused with the long period of time that will be needed to resume normalized relations. Both Cuba's path to reforming its economy and the path of normalizing bilateral relations will be evolutionary and deliberative. From the standpoint of the administration, we have chosen engagement over isolation, which we believe will allow us to work more effectively with Cuba across a variety of issues, including encouraging Cuba to embrace free market, pro-growth policies. And as the President acknowledged in December, Cuba has already made some reforms to gradually open up its economy. In fact, Richard Feinberg, in the first row, outlined a few of them in his 2012 report entitled The New Cuban Economy, liberalizing private markets for small businesses, distribution of state lands, private markets for farm products, and the selling of automobiles and homes. And as Richard noted in his 2013 study, the number of self-employed Cuban workers has nearly tripled since 2009. That said, this process will clearly be a long one. And the leading reason is because the Cuban economy possesses deep structural challenges. And we are all well of them, a population half the size of Shanghai and defined by years of negative growth, an infrastructure system that cannot adequately handle trade, transportation, or digital commerce, a very slack labor market due to state sector roles shedding nearly 600,000 jobs, and an industrial sector that produces at less than 50% of 1989 levels, according to Richard's report, and a rising dependency ratio driven by an aging population, which runs counter to much of the developing world, according to my fellow panelist, Juan Triana, who you will hear more from. And these last two points dovetail into the final narrative I would like to discuss today. I think it is safe to say that the Cuban economy can best be described as one that has been stuck in time. And maybe the most telling example of Cuba's economy being stuck in time is the level of its development relative to other countries in the region. So I think it is worth comparing Cuba's economic growth with that of four nations who have embraced the policies of open markets, individual empowerment, and institution building. Of course, I am referring to Chile, Colombia, Mexico, and Peru. As of 1970, Cuba's nominal GDP was comparable with Chile, Peru, and Colombia. In fact, the nominal GDP of all four nations was within $3 billion of each other. Cuba was at the low end at roughly $5.7 billion, and Chile was at the high end at just under $9 billion. Now, let's fast forward 40-plus years. Chile, Colombia, Mexico are all top 40 economies in terms of nominal GDP. The closest economy in nominal GDP to Cuba is Peru. In 1970, Peru's nominal GDP was $7.2 billion. Today, it is $202 billion. That is almost three times the value of Cuba's nominal GDP of roughly $68 billion today. As for Mexico, in 1970, Cuba's nominal GDP was roughly 16% of the size of Mexico. Now, let's fast forward 40-plus years. Cuba's economy is now less than 6% the size of Mexico's $1.26 trillion economy. And in roughly 40 years, these four nations not only rose to comprise the Pacific Alliance, but three of them are also now our negotiating partners for the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think all of this speaks to the true value of the new course we are charting with Cuba. This new course, will not mean turning back the clock. What we hope it will mean is starting the clock. But now let us all be clear. We have no illusions about the roadblocks to getting there. This will take time. But charting this new course for the U.S. government means starting the clock on a policy of engagement which offers the best opportunity to expand the political freedoms of the Cuban population, to deepen the connection between the American and Cuban people, and to advance U.S. interests. Charting this new course for the Cuban government means starting the clock on an economy that has been stuck in time over the past several decades. If Cuba fully commits to the policies of free enterprise, that will expand the opportunities, expand the political freedoms, and improve the day-to-day existence of the Cuban people. Finally, as the Cuban people chart this new course, they will be starting the clock on a process, which years from now means their country will no longer be an outlier to its regional peers. Their country will be able to stand right next to them. Cuba will be able to stand next to Chile, a nation that became the very first South American country to enter the OECD. Cuba will be able to stand next to Colombia, a nation that became the third largest economy in the region. Cuba will be able to stand next to Peru, a nation that will soon host the first annual IMF and World Bank meetings in Latin America in nearly 50 years. And Cuba will be able to stand next to Mexico, a country that went from the brink of economic collapse to a member of the G20 in less than a generation. And Cuba will not only stand with these nations in the future under this new course, nations throughout the world will aspire to stand next to Cuba. It is worth noting, I think, that the poem that was read during the president's 2013 inauguration was entitled One Today, and it was written by a Cuban-American poet, Richard Blanco. The poem begins with the line, "One sun rose on us today." I think this is particularly fitting because it encapsulates the highest aspiration we have for successfully normalizing relations with Cuba. That aspiration is for Cuba and the Cuban people to finally experience the very same today with the United States, with its fellow partners in the Americas, and with the world as a whole. Thank you for listening.
Great. Thank you, Stefan, for those comments. And all of our materials will be posted later in the day after the event, both audio and video transcripts. So if you miss anything, you can always consult there. We're now going to hear from Juan Triana and Arch Ritter give us their views on the general picture of Cuba's economy, and then we'll open up for further discussion. Juan.
Ahora sí.
No, we're ready. Since I have terrible English, I'm going to speak in Spanish. Firstly, I wanted to thank Brookings and Ted for organizing this event and inviting me to discuss once again Cuban affairs. And I'm going to try to do it slowly in the 7 minutes that I've been given to give my presentation. I wanted to start reminding you that the process that Cuba is experiencing at this time is began way before December 17th. It's important. The timeline is important. It started in 1986, 87 is when this began, when the Cuban economy became stagnant. And then in the 90s, when there was a deep crisis, and from 87 to 94, there was a crisis, a deep crisis that we endured. The second period from 1994 to 2007, and there was an economic growth period that we had with a lot of volatility, but growth of the Cuban economy and the adoption of a set of policies which opened or made the economy more centralized. There's three periods with three different histories. This latest period, the most important piece of news, of course, is that on the 17th of December, of course, the equation of development may change one of its parameters, which is its relationship with the United States. The other thing I wanted to mention is that in the last few years, the performance of the Cuban economy over the last 5 years has been in growth product. GDP performance has been quite poor. We've grown at a rate that's below 2.5%, which isn't too good. And we continue to face a lot of significant problems of investment and balance of trade. But with some good news on the horizon when it comes to current accounts of the Cuban economy. In 2014, the data on our economy are as good in the current account, and the fact that the government announced that it has revenues of $10 billion worth of in reserves, the government announced it had projections for 2015. In contrast with that result, this is quite different. There's a projected 4% growth and a 27% increase of investment over the prior year, and growth of 3.5% growth, and new loans credits in the amount of $5 billion, which could be the leverage required to allow for a 4% growth rate. The interest, what it would be worthwhile to point out some new issues that have emerged. Yesterday, Grama published new measures that the government agreed to take over the next few days. There's an executive, the Council of Ministers had an executive committee meeting to expand opening and reforming of the opening of the national economy. With regard to the new cooperatives, there are important groups, agreements. And also, there's one cooperative. It wasn't for other sectors, just for this cooperative. So they talked about expanding this particular sector. Secondly, the hiring of workers who are not members of the cooperatives for more than 3 months. Before, it was only up to 3 months. Now the regulations are allowed a year, 12 months, so there can be non-members of the cooperatives who can be hired. And with regard to release from paying taxes, it was 3 months. Now it's going to be 6 months a year. Tax exempt, and you don't have to pay taxes over what you earn from the cooperatives. And this is last week; these were announced, and I think this will represent a big change.
Sistema bancario cubano.
The second set of measures is regarding the banking system in Cuba. I think it's the first time that it's actually recognized what difficulties exist in the Cuban banking system. And so the state functions will now be separated from the business functions of the banks. There will be new instruments and services that will be provided to all the population, including the private sector. There's even a decision to stimulate lending. I'm not sure what the details will be, but there will be new loans available for the country starting about a month from now, approximately. So these are some of the new measures that have been decided on a week ago. So these speak to the continuity of that process. What else has been done? Well, 2 years ago, also new regulations for investments were approved. The attempt is to transform Cuban state businesses so they have greater capacity to make decisions. Now, in terms of results, we don't have information about how many new investments have been approved in Cuba in general, not just in development. What is true is that there are proposals by over 300 businesses in Mariel and outside of Mariel as well. And not long ago in Mariel, the first six businesses had been approved from different countries. They can now begin to operate there. And what's interesting is that thanks to December 17th, there has been tremendous growth in tourism now. There's been in the last 4 months 14% growth. And in terms of Americans visiting the island, this has gone up over 20%. So this is a significant figure. It reflects a new perception.
It's important. Okay, good. Okay.
And here I have for you the results of a survey by a Florida-based company on the business environment in Cuba for foreigners who have businesses and who work in Cuba. I don't have the previous one, unfortunately. I don't know where I put it in this machine, so I can't do the comparison. But I think it's interesting to see, especially the response by those business people to this survey. I have four of those responses. The first one is related to how they see the future for the investments of their businesses in Cuba in the next 4 months, and the response is very positive there, overwhelmingly positive. I was surprised by it. The second one is also very positive if we take into account that only 10% feels that their businesses could suffer in the country or could decline in the near future in the country. I'll just get up. The second one is also very positive. And the third one, related to expectations for the next 3 months, very short term, also mostly positive for these business people for these first 3 months of the year. And the last one, the most sensitive of all, I think, where Cuba has had serious problems in the last few years and so have foreign businesses, the response is also positive. The financial situation of the country and how it is perceived by these businesses in Cuba. So definitely this tells us that there's a change in perceptions regarding the country and its economy. And a significant part of that change, of course, is associated to that news we got on December 17th. And finally, that last company has a projection for growth for Cuba, which is also very positive, between 3.4 for 2015 and 5.3% for the year 2017. And I think that's good. I think we're looking at an important transformation of Cuba's image in the eyes of business people and of the rest of the world. The last, it's not the last actually, but the one more point that I wanted to discuss is related to the pace of transportation. This has been discussed. And I will quote Raúl Castro, something he said yesterday that was quoted in the newspaper Grama when he was talking about the reform process in Cuba. And I will do it as slowly as possible so the interpreters can translate it. He said, human beings are the ones who put forth the proposals, also those who approve it, also those who lead the country. We don't always have experience in these tasks. Therefore, everything we do needs to be subject always to critical or constructive criticism, rather. So I think there's something that is slowing down transformation in Cuba, and it is related to the lack of expertise. And secondly, we have some rather blurry lines, and this has not been resolved from an academic perspective or from a political perspective. And some of these boundaries, some of these lines really have a lot of weight. For example, what is of the state and what isn't? What is proper management? The relationship between planning and the market? The experience of a government that's very focused on income rather than efficiency. And there's also equality. That's another issue, another area that needs to be defined in our country. And finally, I know I'm almost out of time, I wanted to talk about after 2015, because usually we talk about the present and the past. What Cuba is facing this year is a serious process. Many different processes are taking place at the same time. Next year, there will be a new Congress for the Communist Party. There will be significant modifications of the country's constitution. And during the first phase of it, a long-term development program will be discussed. There will be a new generation of political leaders leading the country. And this is what we all hope, that this process, reconstruction, this rebuilding of the U.S.-Cuba relationship will continue. Also, the process of improving relations between Cuba and the European Union. An agreement needs to be negotiated with the Paris Club. And there will be a more open economy with greater participation by the market from foreign direct investment and new economic agents. We'll need to think about the role of the new Cuban diaspora, which is different from the previous one in everything, including their plans for their lives. And Cuba will become a new society, will need to have new characteristics. So in this process and this aspiration of becoming a prosperous country where at some point perhaps we can approach countries such as Colombia or Mexico or Chile, we still don't want to lose what the revolution has helped our country gain. These other countries have not reached us in terms of the development expressed as the well-being of much of their population. And it's true that we are not having an IMF meeting this year. That's good. But we had a fundamental involvement in the fight against Ebola in Africa. This is something none of those countries did. Thank you.
Thank you, Juan. I think that was a great way to start with a comprehensive look at the various factors, including a look ahead, which is really important. Arch, please give us your reflections.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure and privilege to be here at Brookings. I thank you for the opportunity, Ted. It's wonderful to be in Washington for a good news, good times conference on Cuba. In fact, when I was trying to sum up my message in the form of a title, the title that came up was The Cuban Economy, Good Times Ahead. And that is something because people who have focused on the Cuban economy for some years have focused on problems. But looking forward, things look a whole lot better in Cuba now. Well, what I would like to do in this presentation is to talk about macroeconomic prospects in the short, medium, and long term, but focusing on the medium and long term. And then I'd like to make a couple of comments on prospective institutional structures for the Cuban economy in the long term. Well, first, the short term. I define the short term as being one in which the U.S. policy does not go that much further, and in which reforms within Cuba move slightly, but not in a dramatic way. So it's close to the status quo with gradual changes. I think, as Juan indicated in his chart, the benefits of that are being predicted for the next few years. I think the impacts of American tourism in Cuba, of remittances and so on, are going to be positive, modest at first, but building to a tsunami in the future. Whoops. Too loud? Oh, sorry. So in the short term, I think the results look good, maybe not ultra-dramatic, but strong. In the medium term, I would define that as being full normalization, but without dramatic major changes in economic policy within Cuba. I would guess that might start in maybe the last years or may of Raul's presidency, or maybe after his presidency. And then I think with full normalization, we're going to see major amounts of investment in Cuba from the Cuban-American community, from United States, and from other countries who want to invest in Cuba to get access to the U.S. market. So I think we're going to see major increases in foreign investment. I think we're going to see big increases in exports, big technological transfer. We're going to see major synergies between the Cuban-American community in the United States, especially Miami, and Cuba. And those should bear very, very good fruit. One question mark in my mind, one ambiguous element in all of this is Mariel, the export processing zone constructed $850 million by Brazil. That'll have to be repaid at some point. That is proceeding slowly. And there are the difficulty. Well, there are a couple of problems with that. One is that it may be very successful in a sense, because China and other countries may invest there in future to get access to the U.S. market, paying no taxes for 10 years, and then only a 12% tax thereafter, and other benefits. But the problem for Cuba is limited value added, limited taxation. The problem for the United States may be special access to its market with sort of high implicit subsidization. So that's a question mark. In the longer term, I would define that as full normalization plus major reforms. Major reforms being monetary and exchange rate, unification, convertibility, further liberalization for small and medium enterprise, and so on. My prediction would be that at that point, there should be major expansion, major improvement in the Cuban economy. And I would draw on Alexander Gershenkron. Some of the old-timers here might remember that name. But he wrote a book back in the 60s entitled The Advantages of Being a Latecomer. When one is moving into modern technologies late, you adopt the latest technology, the best technology. That gives you an advantage. Well, Cuba has a huge international backlog of technology which it can incorporate in services, agriculture, construction, everything. So that should increase productivity in all sectors of the economy. That should be very positive. So my thinking is that in time, Cuba should do very well. A comment I'd like to make, if I have time here, on future institutional structures. Cuba could have many possible institutional economic futures. Right now, it has a mixed economy, state sector, joint ventures, cooperative sector, private sector. We're going to see the state sector shrink. We're going to see that the cooperative sector expand, small enterprise sector expand, and maybe joint ventures, which are state-foreign combinations, become more important. Well, this raises a major issue for me. And just as background, On the one hand, Cuba has a significant and large population of independent entrepreneurs. In fact, Fidel said back in the 70s or 60s that he wanted Cuba to be a giant school for socialism. As it has worked out, Cuba has been a giant school for entrepreneurship for various reasons that I won't go into. So with the various liberalization moves that have been made, we've seen entrepreneurship burst above ground and flourish. On the other hand, Cuba has a large conglomerate, oligopolistic, monopolistic state enterprises, many of them military-owned, many of them involved with some sort of crony state capitalist phenomena. So my concern in future, the easiest thing for some future Cuban government would be to privatize the state enterprises by simply selling them, these conglomerates, to big foreign buyers, Walmarts, Lowe's, McDonald's, Hilton, whatever. That would be the easiest thing. That would earn revenues. That would improve technologies pretty quickly. The long-term cost would be profits being expatriated forever. There would be distributional implications of that, concentration of income in terms of the owners, and loss of Cuban character, I would say. Well, the decision then is whether to permit sort of a Walmartization of the Cuban economy in 10 years or so, or to cooperativize it, that's another option, or to boost small Cuban enterprise. Well, this is in order to prevent some sort of Walmartization, this is going to require a strong foreign investment policy to define the character of the foreign investment and foreign takeovers. So that's a tricky thing. Speaking personally, and this is my last comment, I really like Toronto. I really like Miami. I really like Cleveland, well, sort of. But I would not like Havana to become a copy of even Toronto, but definitely not Toronto. So I would like Cuba to maintain its uniqueness, and that is going to require some control on foreign investment and the evolution of the private sector. Well, the same thing goes for Cuba. I would like Cuba to keep its Cuban character. So many thanks.
Thank you, Arch. I think we've got a great way to look at the various issues on the agenda. We've got maybe 20 minutes or so to have a dialogue. Let me pose a question that I think was sparked in part by Arch's typology of, you know, full normalization plus major reforms. That idea, which is quite hopeful, will involve getting there from here a tremendous number of zigzags and steps forward and steps backwards. And I'm wondering if the three panelists could comment a little bit on that interim period between now and then. And I'm thinking in particular of the dynamic of the embargo. We'd still face a very comprehensive U.S. embargo that will require Congress to take action. And the question for us in the United States, of course, is to have a really lively debate with as much information as possible on the table about the pros and cons of the embargo. And I'm just wondering if you could play out for us a little bit how you see the debate around the embargo affecting the pace of change in Cuba. Will it be more likely that the Cuban government will want to wait and hold back on a process of reform until it actually sees that the U.S. is prepared to lift the embargo? Or will it choose to go ahead with a process of major reforms, regardless of the pace of change on the embargo, because it sees ultimately the day when the U.S. market will open up at great advantage to the Cuban economy? Could you guys comment on that briefly? All three of you, please.
Well, I leave it to my colleagues to comment on what the reaction is likely to be in Cuba. But obviously, legislative action is required to lift the embargo. And I think the president has taken many of the steps towards normalizing relations. But in fact, Congress must pass legislation to do that. And so I'm not good at the parlor game of guessing what the timeline and process might be to get there, other than to say that I think it's been clear by this administration that we are encouraging the Congress to do just that. But I think, Ted, to your point, I think we do have to be careful about maintaining an appropriate pace in this process such that we don't lose enthusiasm down the road, which is to say, I think there's been a lot of excitement here in the United States, a lot of excitement, I understand, in Cuba. I think that's reflective of the sold-out, overflowing crowd you have today. And what I would hope wouldn't happen is that would begin to wane if the embargo is not lifted in the near term, which I think really causes all of us to have to be, you know, vigilant and to continue to kind of work within the constraints that we have to work within to talk about the benefits of the end point in this journey.
Well, as Paul Marcani said, it is a long and winding road. In my personal opinion, really is a long, long, long and winding road. Because embargo is more than one law. It's a really net of laws. And it's too difficult to lift embargo in maybe in 1 year or in 2 years. I don't see the end of the embargo in the next 1 year and a half. But in terms of the process in Cuba and the pace of the process in Cuba, I want to remark that that the environment and context is everything in business. And, of course, if Cuba can have a better context in order to make business, is good. And maybe the pace of the transformation could be different dynamic in the context. For instance, when I showed the slide, the business environment and the business perception for the foreign companies today is quite different. And many, many different groups of businessmen is going to Cuba every week in order to smell, to see what is happening in Cuba. And it's the first time that the end of the tunnel is really close. It's the first time. So, in my personal opinion, could be positive if the pace of the lifting of the embargo go ahead in the next month.
Yeah, a very quick response. Whoops. I agree with what has been said. I think if the embargo were to end quickly, which is unlikely, I think that would encourage a much more rapid process of reform in Cuba. But with such a slow unwinding, as you put it, of the embargo, I can't see that the reform pace is going to accelerate that much. Raul Castro has shown himself to be a very careful, very cautious reformist, unlike his brother, who would make massive changes very, very quickly. Raul seems to be very pragmatic and very cautious in his actions. So he has a couple of more years in his era. I think that he will want to consolidate and tweak the reforms that are in operation, and he would like to solve the monetary issue, but that also is a difficult one to disentangle. So I think that the process of reform is going to wait until the embargo happens, which is going to wait until something happens in Congress.
And, of course, some people say, well, Congress isn't going to start moving on this until more change happens in Cuba. So there is a real dynamic that gets complicated very quickly on this. And ultimately, both sides need to make their own decision based on their own interests on how and the timing of going forward. Why don't we open it up to any questions that you may have? There should be a microphone coming forward. If you could identify yourself and try to keep your comment relatively brief. And I see, yes, Ricardo, please.
Pegado dos.
I am Ricardo Torres.
Ana. So just a quick comment. So now that you mentioned that it's a obvious dynamic, right? Things happening in Cuba, things that could happen in the U.S. Congress, U.S. in general. So I think we have to take into account also that interests might be very different from each side. And my point is that there is a huge asymmetry between Cuba and the United States in terms of economic dimension, political power, and all that. So, I mean, restoring full economic ties with Cuba is not a big deal for the United States. So the power of this is symbolic. It's very symbolic. So it's very important from that point of view. For Cuba, restoring full economic ties with the United States is a huge deal. It could change everything forever in every possible dimension. So I think it's understandable that the Cuban side would like to proceed carefully, not to derail, not to do anything that could derail the whole process. So again, let's bear in mind that asymmetry when we analyze, you know, the dynamic of this process. And by the way, as I mean, we all know that, but Cuba is not imposing sanctions on the United States. It's the other way around. So, and obviously, Cuba is suffering from the fact that it's a very small country. So, I mean, the list of priorities, I mean, for the U.S. in terms of strategic issues, is not important. So, if Cuba were Saudi Arabia or something like that, so it would have been very different. So, I think it's important to understand that a small country, and it's a big deal for Cuba, this whole process. So, I mean, it's understandable, in my opinion, that this is proceeding the way it is. Thank you.
Can I just make one comment? Because, of course, I think we concur that from an economic perspective, we are starting at wildly different places, and there are wildly different implications for our respective countries. But I would like to say that I also believe that we do have a commonality of interests, and that is we both hope that these changes that have already been made and that will be made will empower the Cuban people and will fundamentally move Cuba towards greater openness and prosperity. And that is something that the United States wants. I believe that is something that the Cuban government wants. And hopefully that end point will help us meander through this long and winding road together effectively.
Other questions? Please. Can we get a microphone?
As a layperson,
can you identify yourself, please?
James Gomez from New York. As a layperson, not a Cuba expert, what more can be done on an executive action basis by the president without congressional action to further open up relations or normalize relations between the two countries?
Sure. Well, I'm not sure that I could be precise in terms of additional executive actions. What I can say is that what we are doing and what the entire administration is doing is I think, talking about the benefits of where we hope this process will take us. So I think there is in fact complete consensus within the administration that the old policy was failing and that this is a policy that we should continue to march down the road towards. It is more than just the embargo, however. There are also our restrictions, for example, in the Commerce Department about what we can't do. So as Ted said, I'm responsible for trade and investment for the United States in advancing our export interests. Because of other regulations, we, for example, are not allowed to provide export assistance to U.S. companies at the moment, outside of that narrow band of industries that were previously allowed by license. So I think there are other things, and as I think Juan said, this is not just one law. This is a network and web of laws. So, you know, hopefully we'll be able to continue to chip away at them.
Well, let me comment on this question, which is a very important question, because I think it's an ongoing debate about how much authority the president has to go further. The general sense has been, especially over the last several years, that the power of the president was obvious in the things that he could do, exceptions to the embargo, to move forward. The announcement of December 17th and the announcement since then, the president has used most of that authority, in my view, to do what he's done. And now I think the burden falls on, number one, those actors on the U.S. side to take advantage of the changes that the president has made. It's not just travel and remittances. I mean, we can now extend further economic and trade opportunities, maybe not with the help of the Commerce Department, but through private initiative. And the Airbnb is a perfect example of how a U.S. company can do something, get involved in the Cuban market that also very much fits the overall policy approach Stefan mentioned of empowering the Cuban people and allowing them to develop their own economic activities. And I think a lot more can be done, including in the charitable humanitarian space, people-to-people and humanitarian types of academic exchanges. There's so much more that can be done, and we should really fill in the cement of this brick house that we're trying to build as quickly as possible and take advantage of those changes. What more the president can do is really, I think, not much more in my view. I think it really falls to Congress to have its own debate and discussion, in the meantime for other actors to fill in the gap. We have lots of hands now, so let me take three at a time. Here, Rolando, and then here, and then the middle.
Rolando Nillo, I'm an attorney. Going back to the question about what else could be done, specifically on the export regulation, by removing Cuba from the list of the terrorist countries, there would be certain impact on export regulations. Do you anticipate any publishing in the Federal Register of those changes soon, and specifically the impact on export of the U.S. component for export from third countries? I believe there would be a change on that percentage and in certain products. Thank you.
Okay, and then right here.
Hi, Linda Delgado with Oxfam. I'm just wondering, how much information do you have about what the Cuban people want and what the Cuban government wants with respect to development and the Walmartization that was being discussed earlier? Do they want to move very quickly? Do they want to go slowly and protect the good and the special? What is the sense there?
Okay. And one more in the middle. Yes, this gentleman with his hand up.
Hi, Jose Gabilondo, Universidad Internacional de la Florida.
University of Florida. Wonderful presentations. I think what you're all talking about, it is official action, actions of the state. But to what extent are these processes unleashing dynamic energy, things like the invisible hand that will have their own life, and they can go hand in hand, and they can lead to unforeseen effects.
Juan, do you want to take this?
Okay. I want to begin with the last question, because I think it's a very, very, very interesting question.
From my personal point of view, what's happening today in Cuba is truly that there has been unleashed processes have been set in motion that one way or another fall outside of the official channel. So, for example, what's happening in the private sector today, it's amazing.
Than 2,800 new restaurants in the country. And this restaurant means demand for the others, for the other business. And it's the same like if you see in the case of the tourist sector. Today, the private sector have more than 18,000 rooms in rent. It's the second largest business tourist in Cuba today. And It means demand for other business. Pasa lo mismo con otras cosas.
The same thing's going on with other things at this time in Cuba. In other words, the same relationship that exists between Cuba and the Cubans who live in Cuba and Cubans who live outside, the relationship has changed significantly.
The diaspora, the new Cuban diaspora, I am referring to the new people who is going out of Cuba under the new law, or under the new migration law. And it's different, totally different. Even in the case of the young people who was going out of Cuba to get some job or to get some different career in other universities. It's totally different. I think it is important. En el caso de la otra pregunta,
in regard to the other question, actually, what is the Cuban people really want? What pace is acceptable to them? And what's the pace accepted by the government? The government is very clear.
Hacer todo con muchísimo.
The government's going to be very cautious and with as slowly as is required.
The process is really, really deep in the case of Cuba. And it changed not only the economy, but the society too. In the case of the people, well, the first data is when Cuba launched the los lineamientos económicos y sociales.
Social and economic guidelines, and that original guideline was changed and about 60% of it was changed. That was the first boundary.
First limit of the reform in Cuba. Even the people was more conservative than economists. Yeah. Ahora es diferente.
Now it's different. I believe it's different now because there's a person, it's like a snowballing effect in the economy and Cuban society, which is very typical of any transformation and reform process. As soon as you start with these reforms, new reforms are required, and there's a snowball effect, and this creates expectations among the people. In any case, I would like to explain something. Cuba is not Havana. Remember that. I want to explain something. Sometimes we view Cuba as if Cuba was Havana. Havana is very important. I'm from Havana, and I'm from the industrial. And I mean, no confusion about it. I am. But when you leave Havana, it's a horse of a different color. And people have to have time to get used to the new situation. Nobody goes to bed being a state official and then wakes up being a successful entrepreneur the next morning. So there's a period of time that you have to give to people. And I believe even though the government doesn't say, this is part of the philosophy that the government is following for this transformation, these major changes, even though it may not say so.
On what the Cuban people want, I don't pretend to know. But I was in Cuba in April for a period of time, and what struck me was the optimism of everybody I met. It was a sort of a changed environment. There was an interesting survey that I'm sure most of you saw in the Washington Post here about a month ago. Any survey in Cuba has its difficulties, but that was about maybe one of the best ones. Found that 97% were in favor of the normalization. They had a listing of people's personal objectives and the most important objectives, and I've forgotten that list, but that gave some indication. What I do remember is the Cubans were asked, do you have a favorable opinion of Fidel, Raul, and Obama? I remember these numbers. Fidel, 41%, I think. Raul, 46% favorable opinion. Obama, 58.
Yeah, much higher.
And that struck 80, me until
80%. Much higher. 80. Obama,
oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Well, that seemed very impressive to me, incredible. But then I thought, in Canada, we would get exactly the same result.
So maybe I can just quickly do the first one, which is how do companies avail themselves of opportunities that currently exist before the embargo may be lifted in the future. And so obviously it is important for U.S. companies to understand the categories of goods and services that can be currently exported to Cuba. The best way to do that frankly, is to address specific questions to one of two places, the Bureau of Industry and Security, BIS, and the United States Department of Commerce, or the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control, which is called OFAC. So I think those are the two places to go. What I would say, again, as a former business guy, this is about knowing your market, knowing your customer, understanding the challenges in order to be successful within the constraints that currently exist.
I'm afraid that we have come out of time, and we'll have lots more time to continue and get deeper into some of these issues. Please stay in your seats, because we're just going to have a switch of the panel, and we'll begin right away. The next panel will be on issues of financing Cuba's development, which is a critical part of the puzzle. But please join me in thanking the panel for this discussion.
Barbara Kochwar. I'm a neighbor from across the street at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and with Georgetown University, and I'm thrilled and honored to be part of this very interesting conference. I think we've already learned a lot, and we have much to learn from this panel, which is on financing challenges in Cuba. And the participants are particularly well-placed to talk about this. Cuba obviously has challenges to financing its growth, development, and trade as a result of external factors, the embargo, but it also has a number of very interesting and very complicated domestic challenges, which hopefully will become more and more relevant and overshadow the external factors. We have a wonderful panel, starting with Richard Feinberg, and anybody who's been paying attention to Cuba over the last little bit knows Richard Feinberg, but I will introduce him anyway. He's a non-resident senior fellow in the Latin American Initiative here at Brookings, and in the winters, he's a professor of international political economy at the School of International Relations and Pacific Studies at the University of California in beautiful San Diego, and does his field research in Cuba, where he has done seminal work on emerging entrepreneurs in the middle class, so he can tell us when Cubans, you know, go to sleep as bureaucrats and wake up as successful entrepreneurs. He's also an avid consumer of Cuban services, and so always comes back and shows us the quality of the Cuban service economy through his haircuts. So he was also at the National Security Council, where he was the principal architect of the 1994 Summit of the Americas, so has a wide experience in inter-American relations, has served as the president of the Inter-American Dialogue. And I'm not going to read the rest of your bio because that will take too much time. But his publications are available on the most recent on Cuba, are available on the Brookings website. Good reading for all. Sayra Pons comes to us from Cuba. She's a researcher and instructor at the Center for the Study of the Cuban Economy. She's a 2008 graduate of the University of Havana in economics. She's a statistician and an econometrician, and she's been looking at foreign direct investment in Cuba, issues of inflation, taxation, human capital, has done some really interesting work on fiscal policy in Cuba. So I'm really interested in looking to see what she has to say. Germán Ríos is the strategic director of strategic affairs at the CAF, the Development Bank of Latin America. He has a long history also. He's taught macroeconomics at the Catholic University in Caracas in Venezuela. He's an expert on fiscal policy, cost-benefit analysis, and microeconomics. And he will be talking to us about the challenges of infrastructure and what the CAF is doing and is planning to do to help Cuba with its growth and development. And last but not least, Jaime Doymadios is also a professor and researcher in macroeconomics and growth at the University of Havana. She was recently a visitor at Columbia University in New York last year. She's the assistant dean of the School of Economics in Havana. Her publications include topics related to macroeconomic policies, economic growth in Cuba, monetary unification in Cuba, a topic that weighs heavily on many people's mind. And she'll be talking to us about the internal sources of financing. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Dr. Feinberg to give us his presentation. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Barbara. It's been a wonderful start to the morning. There's such an atmosphere of expectation and optimism. Those of us who have been working on Cuba over the years, this is such a dramatic change, and it's wonderful to be part of such a new atmosphere. It's a pleasure to be on this particular panel with two outstanding Cuban economists, Saida and Yaima. And also with my good friends Germán and Barbara. There's no more important topic for Cuba than development finance. The island, despite the optimism of the morning's panel, is still mired in a low investment, low growth trap. Investment to GDP is only about 10%. That's way, way below the regional average of 20 to 25%. 10% investment GDP is not even enough to replace the aging capital stock, not enough to replace and modernize the housing stock, as is obvious to anyone who visits the major cities in Cuba. If we take the official numbers of GDP at $80 billion, then we need another 10% of that to be for investment to get to your 20% total. That means Cuba needs $8 billion more per year in investment, most of which would have to come from external finance. So how do we get that additional $8 billion in external finance each year for Cuba? And I would identify four major potential sources for this investment finance. One, tourism. Two, other forms of foreign investment outside of tourism. Three, a topic already broached today, the diaspora, both the new diaspora, as Juan Triana discussed, as well as the older diaspora, and the international financial institutions. So first, on the Cuba, on the tourism. Tourism is clearly the one area where you could get a quick shot of growth for Cuba. Who here in this room doesn't have friends and relatives who are dying to visit the island? The constraint, in fact, is on the supply side. Can Cuba put together enough beds? Can they overcome the shortage of rooms, as well as the other services required for a good and healthy tourism sector? And can Cuba put in place not only enough hotels and rooms, but also the quality of services and the variety of tourism destinations that will be necessary for repeat visits to make tourism sustainable in Cuba? Last year, the Cuban government released a portfolio of 246 desired investment projects. Tourism was at the top of that list, a whole series of potential projects, including tourism, condos, golf resorts, all laid out by the government of Cuba. They even told us how much it would cost to play a game of golf, $70 to $85. 18 holes, not bad, much cheaper than in Florida. So all of you guys who like to play golf, the potential is laid out by the Cuban government. However, at the same time, the government, according to that report, is setting aside most of the really juicy tourism opportunities for itself. That is to say, the high-return, low-risk locations of urban Havana and the Varadero beaches, in those prime areas, according to the Cuban government document, international participation will be the exception. That is to say, the safe yields are reserved for state-owned firms, especially Gaviota. But do Gaviota and other Cuban state-owned enterprises, do they have the capital and do they have the hospitality expertise to ensure repeat visits and to build beds fast enough to meet the surging demand? I would argue that in tourism investment, it's time for the Cuban government to place the national economic interest above the interests of particular state-owned enterprises and to open the door wide to international investment in tourism. Also, that the government now, not later, design a smart regulatory framework, new institutions to ensure sustainable and healthy tourism. The second major source would be foreign direct investment outside of the tourism sector. Given Cuba's very poor credit rating, Cuba will continue to have very limited access to bank finance, even after being removed from this terrorism list. So that Cuba will have to look to foreign direct investment, which is official Cuban government policy. Minister Malmierka has suggested a target of $2.5 billion of inflows per year. We all know, and I think they'll be discussed more in the panel this afternoon, many, many reasons why foreign investors in general, with some exceptions, remain very frustrated with the Cuban business climate. Delays and uncertainties with regard to monetary reform, foreign exchange shortages, rigid labor market practices, inadequate and poor infrastructure, and the extraordinary lack of transparency with regard to project approval. We hope that many of these long-standing constraints will eventually be eased in Mariel. We hear stories of some early project approvals that Juan Triana mentioned, but with distressingly little detail. Fundamentally, the government of Cuba will have to decide, does it really consider foreign direct investment a major pillar of its future development strategy? And will it make Cuba cost competitive with regard and relative to alternative locations for investors in the Caribbean and worldwide. Third source of foreign investment, a topic largely forbidden up until now, although Juan Triana put it on the table, the future role of the diaspora, the old and new, in investment. At 2 million individuals in the United States, that's nearly 20% of the population on the island, and infinitely richer in financial assets. Remittances, the good news here is remittances are projected to jump from $1.2 billion a year. Sometimes the numbers you see in the media are exaggerated. From $1.2 billion to double to about $2.4 billion next year as a result of President Obama's easing of transfers and raising ceilings. Much of these transfers will go to finance the emerging private sector. But so far, those investments have to be informal, sub rosa, based on trust. Therefore, they are suboptimal and less efficient than they would be. So what we need in terms of flows from the diaspora, we need to lift them out into the sunlight so that they can be more efficient and more legal. The final source of flows would be the IFIs. Germán will discuss the CAF. The U.S., of course, is not a member of the CAF. Cuba is the only country in the world other than North Korea, which is only half a country, that's not in the Bretton Woods institutions. It's up to Cuba to decide when, it wants to join the IFIs. But the U.S. should not stand in the way. With the normalization of diplomatic relations, the U.S. should look to normalization of international financial relations with Cuba. The U.S. executive should open discussions with our Congress on amending legislation that restricts U.S. policies toward Cuban engagement with the IFIs. So, in conclusion, these four potential sources of international finance, tourism, other FDI, the prosperous diaspora, and the resource-rich international financial institutions. Together, and with the right incentives in Cuba, of course, these four sources could inject the required $8 billion per year to propel Cuba onto a more dynamic and sustainable path of economic growth. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Next, we'll hear from Zaira Pons, Dr. Pons.
Okay, bueno, muchas gracias por la invitación.
Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm going to speak in Spanish because I feel much more comfortable. I'm going to try to speak as slowly as possible to give time for the simultaneous interpreting. I'm going to talk specifically about the dilemma, shall we call it, faced by public finances prior to the transformation process that's taken place in the Cuban economy. I mean, a basic, fundamental point of the transformations that are taking place right now is to grant greater autonomy to state enterprises. There is required a change in the relationship between the state enterprises in state so that they, these enterprises, can have and control with greater leeway and freedom and make decisions with regard to investment, with regard to salaries and other aspects. This entails a change between the way in which the state engaged with these enterprises, which was direct control there over. Of all the resources of these enterprises, to moving towards a more a relationship that's more based on, shall we could call, a modern state, modern public finances, a state enterprise state relationship based on taxes, subsidies, and contracts. What is the risk entailed in the, in such a change in this relationship? The fundamental risk is a drop of almost an automatic drop in the revenue for the state for several reasons. Firstly, in Cuba, the tax administration is not a developed administration.
And this is because they were used to dealing with large, very controlled enterprises, and now they need to start to change their procedures so they can deal with companies that need to do voluntary reporting. And if there's greater autonomy, there will be greater production or productivity and greater efficiency. But that is not necessarily what is happening in the 2000s. And one of the reasons why there was a sort of regression in decentralization in the 90s was precisely because the state enterprises had ceased to contribute as they should to the state. So the relationship between a weak tax administration and this dilemma where greater autonomy doesn't necessarily generate greater productivity, this is one of the elements that could cause a reduction in the revenue of the Cuban state. Another element that might influence this is the significant number of tax exemptions being granted to foreign companies. Archibald Ritter was talking about this. For foreign companies, there are 8 years, and for those in Mariel, it's 10 years. So this means that a significant portion of new companies that will develop in the Cuban economy in the next few years will simply not be contributing to the state budget. Significant production expansion will not necessarily mean the same increase in the budget. And then finally, we have our national non-state-run enterprises. These today contribute approximately 4% to the total public revenue. So it's a very limited contribution. And a significant part of the explanation for this is that trend towards tax evasion that these businesses show for various reasons that we can discuss later. But among these, again, we see the weakness of the tax administration in terms of estimating the revenue of these companies, the very high fiscal load that these businesses represent, and the lack of a tax culture, which means that often there is no understanding, and also the weakness that I mentioned that makes these companies sometimes report incorrectly. They don't understand also that they can receive something in exchange for this payment. They think it's a payment that they need to make in order to get a license, etc., but they don't understand that this is an important mechanism that will then translate into health services, education, etc. They don't understand this link, so the decision tends to be underreporting or tax evasion. So that's another factor that can affect public finances in this transformation process. So what is the dilemma that the state faces? Well, the main problem is that 50% of public spending today go to health and education exclusively. They represent 20% of our Cuba's GDP. And this is an expenditure that has great limitations in terms of being able to be reduced, because if there's consensus among the population in Cuba today, it is that universal and free health and education are sacred, not to be touched. So there are two elements. Public revenue. If there's decentralization, then there could be a decrease here. And also what I mentioned about tax evasion. So there could be a significant increase in the fiscal deficit for this reason. And I think we will talk about this more later, but this really points to an urgent need to develop a public debt market that is consolidated. For approximately 2 years now, the Cuban government has been issuing sovereign bonds, but these are bought only by Cuban state banks. 2.5% interest, 20 years, etc. So it's not yet an organized market in the sense that there is no free participation. Not everyone can have access to it. So these are probably the next steps that we should take, at least in terms of renegotiation or the sell of these debt documents that cannot be renegotiated at this point. So anyway, these are the points that I wanted to refer to. Thank you. Thank you. Very interesting. Now we have Germán Ríos. Thank you.
My first dilemma is whether I should speak English or Spanish, but since I don't have much time, I will speak Spanish. It's faster for me. But I will try not to be too fast. First of all, I wanted to thank Brookings for the work it's done, Ted, Richard, and the rest of the working group on Cuba, because truly they have opened many doors. They do marvelous work. And those of us who have an interest in Cuba and who are watching what is happening there, I think it's an academic and intellectual contribution that they've made that has been fantastic. So I want to congratulate them and tell them how happy I am to be here. I wanted to refer to 3 points. One, regarding infrastructure, I work at CAS, the Latin American Development Bank. It's multilateral. It's similar to the Inter-American Development Bank or the World Bank. We specialize in infrastructure. And on this, first of all, I'd like to discuss some of Cuba's investment needs regarding infrastructure and what instruments could be used in the short and medium term to satisfy some of these needs. Secondly, I wanted to talk about small and medium-sized enterprises. And as Richard has said, it is a very dynamic sector. And given the financing restrictions that exist currently for this sector in Cuba, we should also think about ideas of ways that we could support them. And finally, I wanted to talk about the relationship that my bank, CAF, is developing with Cuba. We have a lot of hope and expectations. I'm working with my colleagues from the University of Havana, with Brookings, with the Inter-American Dialogue, the Council of the Americas, and many others who are interested in this. The challenge faced by Cuba in terms of its infrastructure is huge. Basically, they need to renew their infrastructure, and this would involve enormous investment. But if we can compare them to the rest of Latin America, as was done in the first panel, we see that the rest of Latin America is also facing huge challenges in this field. In the case of Latin America, where we invest 3% of our GDP, we should actually invest 6% of it in infrastructure. So fiscal resources that the countries have available for this, plus anything that multilateral organizations can provide, is simply not enough. And this is the case in Latin America and will be the case of Cuba as well. It cannot be done without private sector participation. So that is one comment I wanted to make.
It is calculated that in Cuba, there is a need to build or repair over 4 million houses. And infrastructure in terms of highways, ports, airports, train systems, public transportation, it would be about $25 billion that would be needed. And these challenges even touch other areas that are important, such as water and water projects, where the entire infrastructure needs to be modernized, energy as well, telecommunications, and this is a very important one for some of the topics mentioned by Richard. How can we finance these areas? It's very complicated because normal financing will take time. Cuba, as a non-member of the multilateral organizations, will not really be able to do some of what other Latin American countries did at the end of the 90s and early 2000s when they had their reform processes. They had the support of loans in various fields for infrastructure, health, education. Even the IMF supported them in some of that. And these were bylines for very significant, very large projects, which could not be carried out in this case. Where I see greater possibilities would be in co-financing with development agencies from other countries, the BND from Brazil, China's Development Bank, the KfW from Germany, or from with French cooperation at CAF. We are co-financing renewable energy projects and other kinds of projects with some of these organizations. And as Ted was saying, we need to try to find those gaps where we can gain access. And these amounts will not be enough probably for the first phase, but they will be interesting. We also need to find other ways to invest in infrastructure. We're having an interesting experience in Colombia, Peru, and Uruguay, where we are raising funds from investors. And I'm thinking here of the diaspora. And some of these people might be interested in contributing to these funds. But this would require many changes in the institutional framework, a lot of technical cooperation. This is fundamental because we would need to prepare a byline of projects that can be financed, and for this we would require a lot of expertise in many of the areas we will be working on. And I think the infrastructure revolution in Latin America is an experience that will be very important for Cuba. For example, what is happening now with the PPPs, and I will refer to these very quickly because I think this is more of a long-term issue, because in order to be a PPP you need some macroeconomic conditions that are not present in Cuba yet. So we can have this set of projects, and we can have the possibility of having contracts with different types of specific conditions for what we're doing. So quickly, I will go on to the small and medium-sized enterprises, the SMEs. I think there's great potential in this field in Cuba. We need to find a way to finance them. The traditional way in Latin America is to finance these through second-tier loans or special line credits, credit lines for SMEs. And this can't work in Cuba because of a lack of debt in this financial system. But we could work with infrastructure as we will in infrastructure through cooperative funds. For example, an institution, could be CAF or some other bank, could establish a fund which is based on a third partner, and this could be used to finance these SMEs. And to conclude, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we at CAF are looking towards for the future and how we think we can support Cuba. Not long ago, or last week, there were some statements by Enrique Garcia, the president of CAF, where he said that our long-term objective was for CAF to become a member of our institution, for which there are no requirements in principle because the U.S. is not a member of CAF. but I'm sure there will be some complications as long as the embargo is there. For Cuba, some complications, not only to be part of CAF, but also any other organization, will be where will they get the cash to make the necessary contributions, and they will need to make some sort of a fiscal effort for this to work. I think it's important because it's a way to leverage financing and development. We signed a technical cooperation agreement with the University of Havana, my dear colleagues who are here with me, and we hope that that will be... Also, as Ted mentioned, a possibility for academic exchanges between Cuba and the rest of Latin America, so we can take advantage of the integration of that university with the productive sectors and the Cuban government in order to stimulate technical cooperations in certain areas that we can work on, energy, for example, biotechnology, where there are opportunities and where we can explore with the University of Havana, any exchanges and research opportunities that exist. Also, we are working on creating these funds. This is very preliminary work. One of the problems Cuba has, obviously, they're not a member of CAF, but there is a precedent during the earthquake. We supported Haiti, and they're not members of CAF, but through another third party that was a member of CAF, we were able to do this. So out of the 19 member countries we have, we see that there's political will to support Cuba. And I am convinced that very soon we will be able to establish a fund with one of these countries so that we can help finance SMEs in Cuba. The last point would be that it would be good to work with Havana. I've been there several times. I've met with several authorities there. And our membership, 17 Latin American countries plus Spain and Portugal, they are looking to promote better and deeper relations between CAF and Cuba. And I think in the short term, we will be working on technical cooperation, small projects to fill in the gaps. And we will try to work on the financing of specific projects in the area of SMEs particularly. And hopefully later on we will be able to contribute through financing for some of the bigger infrastructure challenges that Cuba is facing, and we hope it will not be too far in the future. Thank you.
Bueno, muchísimas gracias, Germán. Y ahora...
Thank you very much, Germán. And now if we could give the floor to Dr. Adoy Madios.
I'll try to stick to the question on how to finance the investment we need to grow, right? And it is certainly a challenge, and I completely agree with my colleague that the most important part in this financing is made by the external sources, because filling the gap in investment that we have today with internal savings sounds impossible. I mean, we would have to reduce the private consumption that is already very depressed, which is not an option, or we would have to increase the external debt, which is not an option at all in this moment. But I wouldn't underestimate the possible importance of some room for external sources to finance growth as well. So I'm going to refer to four or five of them in a very optimistic way. But anyway, I think they are important. I think they are important because they would define as well not only the amount of resources available to grow, but also the returns that this foreign investment or other influence would have if they come to Cuba today. The first of them is what we call productivity gains, mainly through efficiency increases. We did some statistical estimations, and we surprisingly found that the average efficiency in enterprises in Cuba is between 15 and 20% if you compare them with the most successful enterprise by sector. And that, of course, is very, very low. Of course, this number is not the same in every sector. In tourism, is a bit higher, and in agriculture, is way much smaller. But just to give us an idea, well, first of all, why do we have this such a low efficiency in the Cuban economy? We think it's mainly related to the incentives and the institutional environment that is avoiding, let's say, actors, enterprises, individuals to develop more rapidly. We estimated that only, well, not only because it's not that easy, but if we get to achieve an increase in productivity, a sustained increase in productivity by 3% for a number of years, and this is something difficult today, but it's something that we accomplished to get in the 90s already. If we obtain this increase, the needs or the minimum needs of investment to grow 6% would drop from 20% to 15% in real terms. Let me make myself clear. This is not that we only need 15%. I'm going to be clear. This is the minimum amount that we need to sustain this growth. So productivity, again, can be one way to relax this dilemma of resources that we're facing. The second possible source of financing is, let's say, it comes from a possible recomposing of GDP. I don't know if you understand the idea, but I wanted to mention two facts. The public spending in Cuba is one of the largest in the world. And that can be consistent with our idea of socialism. I mean, it is expensive to keep the levels of social development we have, and we don't want shortcuts in this. But the public spending is not only social spending. And we think there is a good opportunity of savings in public spending related to public administration. And we had some estimations as well in efficiency in the public sector, and we found out that Cuban public sector is among the most effective in Latin America, but it is also among the most inefficient in the region. Again, related mainly to public administration. Some steps have been made in this direction. For example, the number of ministries has been reduced in the last 2 years in 34%. And the numbers of public enterprises was reduced in 27%. Also, there is an acknowledgement by the government that the government is very inefficient in managing small-scale enterprises. And that's why it is incentivizing this change in the property to cooperative sectors in this small-scale level. And the amount of workers that are now involved in these non-state enterprises is rising rapidly. And it has been said that we expect it to be 35% of the labor force in 2016, I mean next year. So that can give us another source. The third source, possible source, I made myself clear, I'm being optimistic here, can come from a positive reaction of the export sector to the change in relative prices that can come from the depreciation we are expecting to have in the next month of the domestic currency, of the official rate in the domestic currency. Today, every dollar that a hotel or any other export-oriented enterprise gets to obtain is valued one-to-one with the Cuban peso. And that, of course, is an implicit tax to this sector, export sector. And at the same time, it is a subsidy to those enterprises that sell in the internal market but demand imported products. So we are betting on the idea that once this huge distortion is corrected, and of course, depending on the possibility of the domestic supply to react, to adapt, because this is not the only obstacle, we really expect a positive outcome in exports. The last source can come, and it's very related to this one, can come from the possibility to lower the incredibly large income elasticity of imports we have in our economy, that for me is the main restriction to grow today. And just to give you an idea, for every dollar that we get from tourism, nearly 50% goes by imported products. So increasing tourism, of course, it is a way to finance, but if we don't do something, not to avoid losing this income, the return of this increase in tourism and also foreign investment will not be as expected. So, again, net export positive, net exports, and a change in current account might also turn into a way of financing rather than receiving as a destiny. Just a final idea, because I was going to sum up, but just a final idea. I'm not really sure that this new environment, as Ida was saying, is going to cause a large public deficit in the future. It is true that I think that our tax system is very slow and, let's say, I don't know, but inefficiently at all. We don't know how to do it, and we're doing that really slowly. But I want to remind that these enterprises are public. We are giving them more autonomy, and maybe we are charging or we will charge less taxes in the future. But if they really get to react and get more profits, half of those profits in joint ventures or a certain level are going to be for the budget as well. So that might change the picture. Although we would have to expect, how is the public sector going to react to the depreciation when an important number of enterprises are going to get, let's say, exposed, facing problems in their accounting. So to sum up, I strongly believe that what to produce, I mean exports, better than non-tradable goods. The level of productivity in that production and the degree of efficiency in institutions and public administration that accompany the process of changes we're living can become an important sources of financing as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Very interesting, all the presentations. And I think that, you know, you've all raised a number of very strong points and some very interesting questions. And just to start off the question period, I'd like to hear a little bit more reflection, and I think all of the panelists are in a good position to talk about this, in what steps would need to be taken over the next, sort of over the short term, in order to help increase the productivity of the non-state enterprises as the state starts to devolve the role of the state-owned enterprises in the internal revenue, and also what sorts of elements need to be put in place in order to increase the possibility that the state-owned enterprises will become more productive and will be able to play a more important and a more autonomous role in helping to finance not only the Cuban economy's budget, not only the Cuban government's budget, but also help to stimulate an environment in which you can see increases for productivity. So I don't know who wants to take that. Jane?
It's two different questions. One part is the productivity in the non-state.
Right.
And the other is, and what really concerns to me, because it's the larger part, the productivity in the state-owned. Mm-hmm. I think that two important things are related to the productivity, this new sector of non-state enterprises. One of them is competition. We should, and that's something we didn't take into account in the 90s, I think, we should stimulate competitions in almost every of these new activities, sectors that are opening now. Because giving them market power of market. I mean, we'll only give them large profits and will go against their opportunity to reach international levels of competitiveness. So one for me is competition. The second is technology. I mean, if we are betting on activities that are very low technology demanding and that are not connected to the international market because they're not export-oriented activities, we would be making a big, huge mistake. Because if we take into account that those people that are starting to work there are highly qualified, most of them, I don't know most, but a good percentage of them has a degree, and that would be a very, let's say, a social waste. So that's the second. And of course, as Germán is saying, we would have to support this new sector with a good development in infrastructure, not only technology, but also infrastructure. Otherwise, it would be very difficult to increase productivity. I'm thinking, for example, in agriculture. It's almost completely private or cooperative, and still their efficiency is very, very low. Why? No technology, very few competition, no support in transportation or other infrastructure service, so it's really difficult for them. And, of course, they're facing an incomplete market that is giving them the opportunity to earn a, I would say, disproportionate amount of profits. Now, that's in the non-state. But talking about state-owned enterprises, I think we would have to change. I'm thinking that we are about to do it, but not yet. That we will have to change the whole incentive system. Today, the system is designed exactly for the opposite. I mean, the winners in this system we have today are not only individuals, but also enterprises. The winners are the ones who produce less or even with less efficiency. Even the price, the way we form state-owned enterprises, prices are based exactly on their cost. The biggest their costs are, the biggest are the profits they get. So that's insane. That's one thing. I don't want to take a long time on this because this is not the point, but just one thing related to the labor force. We would have to change, and this is painful for us, for Cubans. We Cubans, we are used to have everything. Everybody has everything. So we're coming from an environment with full employment, no layoffs, a very narrow wage scale, and of course, low productivity. So the incentive is to work less each time. We are trying some system now, but the way has to be not to give more wages, which is, of course, great and very welcome, but we have to link the wages and, of course, the enterprise's profits to their productivity. Otherwise, we won't be able. And we would have to take a very close review to the safety net. We're facing a very wide safety net, and the incentive, again, for a regular Cuban is not to work. And he would still be receiving any social benefit as any regular worker or even the best or more productive worker.
Well, I think that's a tremendous panorama of the intertwined challenges facing the Cuban economy. And I think, you know, some questions about how the opening with the United States can potentially help Cuba overcome some of those challenges, I'm sure will come up in the questions. And on that, I'd like to open it up for questions. Please state your name and your affiliation, even if you've asked a question before. Some of our internet viewers may just be joining us and will want to know who asked that brilliant question. I think a mic should be, there's a mic right there, so I think the gentleman over there has a question. Thank you.
Carlos Aladrigas with the Cuba Study Group. I have a question for Zaira. You mentioned that the tax collections from the cuentapropistas amount to about 4% of the revenue budget of the state. What percent is the equivalent percentage of the savings of having taken that 35% of the population that was in the state budget as an expenditure and taken it out of there? How does those two compare? And my question for the panel in general is, if we're looking to make these macroeconomic transitions that are going to be necessary in the future, has anybody made any projections of where Cuba is going to end up in terms of foreign debt at the time of all when this process is completed, given the fact that most likely the state will need to incur significant budget deficits to smooth the macroeconomic transitions on the populations?
Actually, the drop in public, in the size of a public administration, yes, there was a drop of around 560,000 persons were removed from the payrolls of the public sector. But, however, the expenditure in public administration has not dropped. It's not come down. If you compare the performance, this is something that actually I'm not capable of explaining well to you, but when if you analyze the official figures, the expenditure in public administration has actually grown. There were fewer over the last few years. After 2008, Cuba faced quite a complex financial situation. There were cuts in different parts of the items, budget items like social assistance, investment in different things. But there was no reduction in public administration expenditures. So the way I understand this phenomenon is that in actuality, even though there has been mergers between different ministries, there's a reduction in the number of ministries in government office, the functions in and of themselves of oversight and control that many agencies of the central government is to oversee and control state-owned enterprises, these control functions have not been reduced because we are waiting for development of measures to lead to autonomy in the state-owned enterprise sector. So therefore, that's why there can be institutional changes and remove certain ministries. But if the functions of the public administrations haven't changed, the expenditures will not drop. It's very unlikely to reduce these expenditures. With this 35% reduction in public administration did not take place with the corresponding reduction in the number of individuals who work for the government. But one of the elements that has raised revenue in the state coffers is the individual entrepreneur sector, because it's grown people who work freelance workers, because the dynamics of this sector, the independent entrepreneurs and the number of persons involved, et cetera, is not being directly reflected in tax collection. And based on studies conducted by the tax agency, indicated that more than 60% of these, no question, under report significantly their income. So these are some aspects I want to point out. This is not just exclusive of Cuba. It's common. It's been common in many countries that have moved forward in this economic centralization, decentralization in developing market economies, et cetera, that they require a transition period of more than a decade to be able to develop the proper institutions in the public administration that are consistent with a new system, or that go with them. With this state-owned enterprises, another fundamental change is that's coming about in state-owned enterprises is to try to change governance of these state-owned companies, trying to create boards of directors for these state-owned enterprises in some way, in addition to management of these companies, to have different committees to represent the state's interests that are not not be directly a minister telling the state-owned company what it has to do, but rather a board of directors that's made up of even academicians would be members of this in the decision-making process and to increase productivity, but based on the objectives that are in the best interest of Cuban society. This is one of the things that could be done to avoid what happened with the decentralization in the 90s, which represented a backsliding in decentralization because we didn't successfully at establishing these state-owned enterprises to meet their contributions that they were supposed to. They were supposed to contribute a certain amount to the revenue of the state. This is one of the changes that has come about in this way.
If your question, in my model, there is no increase in external debt because there's no borrowing. It's all equity investment or export earnings in the service sector in the case of tourism. I was very glad that Yaima emphasized the links between investment and productivity. Obviously, there's a lot of headroom in Cuba to increase productivity. So if you have a large productivity increase, then the amount of foreign currency that you would need might diminish somewhat. But I think there's a link between all these sources of international finance and potential productivity savings. As Archer Ritter emphasized, importing technology through joint ventures, for example, could enable Cuba to leapfrog dramatically. The offer on the U.S. The U.S. offer on the table to provide all sorts of telecommunication and internet services. There's no reason that Cuba couldn't be wired totally within 2 years if it were really to open up to the offer that is on the table. The possibility for the diaspora to provide both finance and expertise. The idea of technical assistance from CAF and other IFIs and other sources of international education and technical assistance, all of those together could provide really tremendous leaps in productivity on the island. But as I think Yaima and Saira both have emphasized, the state-owned enterprises remain the core of the economy, and there are huge inefficiencies built into those institutions. We've seen in other efforts around the world to improve the efficiency of state-owned enterprises, unless they face a tight budget constraint, you will not get the results that you want in efficiency. And a tight budget constraint in a socialist system is very difficult to impose because of the politics. And so that will be a big test going forward.
I completely agree with Richard. Just to add, the public debt today is about 50%, not the external one, the public debt. It is true that we are having modern traditional sustainability criteria to decide which is the most suitable or, again, sustainable debt, external and public. Now, how is that going to move in the future, the public part? It depends completely on how much do you want to keep protecting, socially protecting. People, but I'm talking directly to enterprises. It was acknowledged already in the guidelines that enterprises that wouldn't get to survive in these new, more demanding, more competitiveness demanding environment would have to be closed. But that hasn't happened yet. And I honestly don't know how are we going to perform that in the future, because, of course, that would mean jobs, among other things. Of course, this, as you were mentioning, this movement of work or labor force into cooperative sectors gives us the opportunity to perform this change in the future. But again, if we keep subsidizing enterprises that we know cannot survive, this deficit will get to I don't know what. Now, depreciation is completely vital in this decision, because the truth is that today, with the overvalued currency, we really don't know which of these state-owned enterprises are profitable or not. And we are subsidizing, for example, hotels, Meliaco Iba, that lives out of tourism completely and seems to be very profitable, receives subsidies from the budget, which is completely insane. And some other companies, enterprises that we think are not profitable at all, do not. So again, we have like a veil in the middle and we cannot know for certain how sound or clear the public accounting is. So after the currency unification process, we would have more data to analyze and to decide. Again, the question is, after this, what are we going to do with those enterprises that we know will not be able to survive? Maybe because they are very technologically obsolete, or maybe because the product they produce is not competitiveness internationally, etc.
Ted, may I take one more question? Oh dear, let's take David Lewis.
Thank you, Barbara. Gracias a Brookings. David,
thank you, Brooke.
Manchester Trade here in Washington. It sounds like we're going round and round and round, and nobody wants to say the word, which is political will. And it's very hard to compete in a seller's market. And Cuba is now in a seller's market because capital can go anywhere in the world, maybe with the exception of North Korea. And in this region, Latin America and the Caribbean, as CAF will tell you, there's no dearth of projects anywhere for equity capital to say, oh, let me go to Dominican Republic, Jamaica, Nicaragua, Mexico, Chile, wherever. And they're saying, we've got the political will to do what it takes. So it's very nice to say, come, there's a good environment, but I don't know any of my clients with equity capital who are going to say, yeah, I'm going to do that, but where's the rule of law guarantees, where's the institutionality that's going to make sure, you know, my risk is minimized. So I'm curious, particularly Richard and Germán, because, you know, we've done this all over the world. This is not new. It's not nuclear physics. What's the political will scenario that you see in Cuba right now for that? Otherwise, it won't happen.
Well, I work for a multilateral, so I cannot talk about political will, but I try to tell you something about my personal experience going to Cuba. But let me make one point first related to the debt. You know, also history teaches us that many of these cases of countries with external debt, you know, they couldn't move forward without a package of IFIs working with them. And from my point of view, I see that they have to make an effort, a fiscal effort. I don't know. I know it is complicated, but they have to do it because they need to make room to let the multilaterals in, because this is the debt that you need now. It's long-term debt, it's project-based, with nice financial conditions, and I know that, you know, they are afraid because the risk of increasing and the fiscal, I know that. But, you know, without that, it will be difficult for them to move forward. With regard to the other question, and we see what is going on Latin America. Everybody is creating funds local in local currency. We are doing three in Peru, Uruguay, and Colombia. You know, the Chinese are also investing everywhere. I think, you know, my perception is that you know, they are you know, in this seminar we were in Havana a month ago. When we listen to the economists and to the government officials, they know exactly what are the problems. That, you know, it's amazing. And they could tell you how the unification of the peso will work and everything. They know that very well. And this is not only the academics, also the officials know this very well. So my feeling, and this is not CAF talking, is that I see the political will, and I see they will be moving forward towards having better institutionality to do all these mechanisms that we are trying to put in place in Cuba.
I wasn't asked the question, but just one thing. I haven't heard anywhere in newspapers, press, or officials saying that we will do what it takes. I haven't heard that, actually. I mean, we are willing to, and I mean we, not the government, but Cubans, to incentivize foreign investment, first because we need it, not just because of the money they bring, but because they bring a lot of very important things that we are lacking, like how to do things, how to manage, how to open to the world. So we need to learn from them. I wanted to say this. Now, we won't do whatever it takes, because we all know that foreign investment has or have experienced in many countries not good results or, anyway, results. But I do feel the political will. Yes, if we ask, and Triana was talking about it, the few entrepreneurs, foreign entrepreneurs that we've had in our country for 20 years, you will listen to, I would say, like 100 complaints to the system. And they would be right, undoubtedly. But I don't have enough information of how many of them have left Cuba in 20 years. That's one point. If they would be afraid that they would be expropriated or something like that, I believe that they would have taken their money away a long time ago. So that's one thing. It is a risky market because it's completely new. It's a completely different system, so it's not the same in the rest of the regions, but it's also like a virgin market. So they also say that their preferability is way more, much larger in Cuba than in any other scenario. This is not my area of expertise, so I will just add that, yes, I feel that the political will, it was in the 90s, but in the 90s we were seeing that, and I think it was quoted like this, as un mal necesario, like something we needed, but we didn't want to. But I think now we need it, and we want to. So maybe that can help to your...
Perfect. Well, I think Saira and Yaima, I think you've offered us some very revealing, very open, and maybe some very revolutionary economic analysis out of Cuba that I think has given us a large scope for thought. Germán, your practical solutions from the point of view of the CAF open up lots of possibilities. The funds that you suggest, maybe there are possibilities for regional projects to start forming and for others to join in. And Richard, as always, a great spot-on analysis of the possibilities and the challenges in Cuba. So please join me in thanking this wonderful panel, and thank you for the interpreters and the organizers.
We'll reconvene in 5 minutes, 11:30. Grab a coffee, bathroom, and come back.